Humility. Lots of people have differing ideas about humility. Reedy Katori says, it's really easy to understand a feeling if you have a humble heart. The only barrier is the pride that doesn't know how to listen. Someone else, Niku Saluja, says, maturity is humility. It is being big enough to say I was wrong, and when right, the mature person need not experience the satisfaction of saying I told you so. I think a lot of people need to work on that, including me. Ted Turner once said, if only I had a little humility, I'd be perfect. Hopefully he was saying that tongue in cheek. Here's another quote. Practice radical humility. He who masters the art of humility cannot be humiliated. By Ralph Waldo Emerson. Someone else said, we need mystery. The creative of wisdom knows this. Mystery fills us with awe and wonder. They are the foundations of humility, and humility is the foundation of all learning. So we do not seek to unravel this. We honor it by letting it be that way forever, said a Native American grandmother explaining the mystery of the universe to her grandson. Another one, the heart that knows how to bow down and say I'm sorry is the heart that loves the most. I heard this in a sermon once. I think I can get on board with that. This quote, Nisan Panwar, that one was by Nisan Panwar. Mother Teresa, a person of great humility herself, said, if you are humble, nothing will touch you, neither praise nor disgrace, because you know who you are. And probably my favorite of these quotes is, it was pride that changed angels into devils, and it is humility that makes men as angels. St. Augustine said that. I think we've all had experiences where we have felt humbled. I was recently watching an old Charlie Rose program that Matt Damon was promoting his newest movie on. He said that he was out with his family when someone asked him to take their picture. He thought they meant they wanted a picture of him. When they looked at him strangely and politely asked him to take their picture, he was rather embarrassed by his assumption, and of course his wife thought it was much funnier than he did. I remember an experience of being humiliated when I was a child. And no, I'm not telling you the most humiliating experience. That story will not be told. But I was in gym class feeling ill in the fifth grade, and I asked my gym teacher twice if he would let me go to the bathroom because I didn't feel well. Maybe that was a common excuse in fifth grade. People wanted to leave class. I don't know. But after several minutes, I realized that I needed to disregard his denials and go to the bathroom anyways. And that's when I learned that that feeling of sick was nauseousness. So I threw up across a large gymnasium, and I vomited all over his new gymnastic mats. The mats he was excited about and talked about for 6 months before that. Of course, the comment a half an hour later in the nurse's office was, if I had to go to the bathroom, I should just go. But I guess it was my fault. But in the fifth grade, that is very humiliating. And sadly, that poor teacher probably never liked me again after that. But today, as Christians, we care most not about how others see humility, but about what God has to say about staying humble and how that should inform our everyday living. Part of the text talks about a popular activity that happens even today, which is the social meal. The dinner party, the potluck, the cocktail party, the family reunion, the Bible study meal, the holiday meal, whatever the situation, however it's worded for that particular event. But basically, we're talking about the social gathering that lasts long enough that food needs to be served. We see in the Bible that important things happen when there's a meal. Feeding of the thousands, the Passover, Maundy Thursday. There are Christians whose favorite day of the year is Maundy Thursday, and I am one of them. Think about it. Jesus gathers his closest friends to eat, drink, and be merry. Jesus washes his friends' feet. He shares his message and future, and he creates what later we would come to know as communion. So we learn that Jesus uses a meal to communicate important truths to his disciples. But I don't know about you, but I use social meals to communicate important truths in my life as well. You can get caught up with others, catch up with others, and have the deep conversations you don't usually have in life. Many only have time to text or email people thoughts during their day and don't talk much. Sometimes at social meals, you end up talking about major truths in your life and get the helpful feedback from others that you were hoping for. Sometimes you get to know people that you don't usually talk to, but you'd like to get to know. At those gatherings, it also gives the hostess a chance to nurture friends and relatives. There are people who just love to entertain. My friend Joyce is like that. When she lived in Ohio, she had an Epiphany party every year to entertain her friends. She came from the Orthodox tradition. She liked to do that, and she liked to have a party when nobody else was having a party. She opened her home to her friends. She often cooked things that others had requested. Favorite dessert, favorite meal. I know sometimes my relatives hand me pieces to a meal and ask me to finish and cook it with that. Or in our family, to have an excuse to have the most heavy and fattening foods that you don't usually allow for yourself. That's Thanksgiving in our family. We break all of Mom's renal dietary restrictions to have one nice meal that she rarely gets to enjoy. Or how about the grill master, right? Some men want an excuse to have a cookout so they can make a fire on the grill and to play with fire, what I call the Cro-Magnon band gathering, the cookouts. At Camp Otterbein, where I once worked, the fourth and fifth grade campers had a term, and we called them the pioneers. But the camp counselors quickly amended that term to call them the pyroneers, because the boys love a playing in the fire. Even though the camp counselors built at least two campfires a day, there were weeks where I didn't even touch the fire because the boys could do it by themselves. Men certainly like to play with fire and have cookouts. Or how about at these social meals? How about games? I know in our family, we always played bridge. Now it's euchre. A lot of people like to play cornhole. People like to play for fun, and they like to play for bragging rights until the next gathering. Yep, in the Bible and also today, many important things happen at these gatherings, both with positive intentions and concerning intentions. And those concerning elements is what I'll talk about real quickly. With the ability to have a social event comes wealth. And often where there is wealth, there is power. Our text for the day discusses this, so am I. My three thoughts involve three questions. Who are we kidding? Who are we forgetting? And who are we called to be? So who are we kidding? The first part of the text talks about picking out a humble seat and allowing the host to invite you to a higher spot. Hopefully all of us here know not to sit at the bridal table at a wedding without asking, but I don't think that's what the text is talking about. It seems we're taught from a young age to posture ourselves well. Be assertive, introduce yourself, sell yourself well to others, talk about your strengths, and posture for advancement. Any job hunting class or book discusses networking or hobnobbing, so to speak. You need to talk to your circle of people, to tell others who you are, what you want, and ask others to help you get there. Then you are to ask them for another person to ask, is asking others about opportunity for advancement and basically asking for their contacts to help you with suggestions. If you're part of Generation Z, you might be reading books about job hunting through social media. You'll read about blogging, getting to know your blogging neighbors, the benefits of microblogging, being more visible to the cyber crowd, and managing digital dirts. I'd be lying if I told you that I hadn't taken this networking philosophy seriously in the past, and we'd all be lying if we said we didn't refer to this philosophy at some point in life. After all, the way to gaining a new position for a job is rarely the ad that you find, but the people that you know. But in our text today, Jesus says that we shouldn't look for the best place to sit at a gathering or hobnob to sit at a higher station either. Rather, we should sit at a humble spot and wait to be invited elsewhere. This might feel awkward if we don't know the people we're called to talk to. This is somewhat opposite of what we might pick out for ourselves. But if we are constantly posturing or networking at social events, then these become instruments for personal gain, and it becomes about ego and not relationships. So we're called to be careful about posturing and networking, and also then being careful that we're not being selfish or self-driven. Question two, who are we forgetting? When we get so absorbed in the fun of social gatherings and events in general, we forget the potential that lies within them for the less fortunate. The opportunity for them to connect and the opportunity for them to get a good meal or a good snack or entertainment. Sometimes I think I forget about the importance of food to life because I have food. If I am considering having people over for a meal, not only do I have food for today, but I have food for company. Even though I live within simple means for American standards, spending money for others is still wealth that most and many don't have. Just this week, it was brought to my attention on the news that thousands of fast food workers are demanding an increase in minimum wage. The last time it was increased was 2009. And this movement is coming from people in a non-food deficient country. In other words, there is enough food here, and even they're struggling. But half of the world lives in what is called a food deficient country. According to WFP.org, there are 10 things you need to know about hunger in 2013. Number one, approximately 870 million people in the world do not eat enough to be healthy. That means 1 in 9 people on Earth goes to bed hungry every night. Number two, the number of people living with chronic hunger has declined by 130 million people over the past 20 years. For developing countries, the prevalence of undernutrition has fallen from about 23 to about 15% over the period between 1990 and 2012. Number three, most of this progress against hunger was achieved before 2008, up until the financial crisis. Since then, global progress in reducing hunger has slowed and leveled off. Number four, hunger is number one on the list of the world's top 10 health risks. It kills more people every year than AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. Frightening. Number five, a third of all deaths in children under the age of 5 in developing countries are linked to undernutrition. Sometimes I wonder if that's the purpose of WIC in the United States. I'm guessing, I don't know. Number six, the first 1,000 days of a child's life from pregnancy through age 2 is the critical window in which to tackle undernutrition. A proper diet in this period can protect children from mental and physical stunting that can result from malnutrition. Number seven, it costs just 25 cents a day to provide a child with all the nutrients and vitamins that they need to grow up healthy. That seems hard to believe, but that's what it said. Number eight, if women in rural areas have the same access to land, technology, financial services, and education as men, the number of hungry people could be reduced by 100 to 150 million. Number nine, by 2050, climate and erratic weather patterns could push another 24 million children into hunger, and almost half of those children would be in sub-Saharan Africa. And number 10, hunger is the single biggest solvable problem facing the world today. And perhaps the most disturbing part of this problem is that according to worldhunger.org, the world currently produces enough food to feed all of the Earth's people. While living in one of the most wealthiest countries in the world, it's easy to forget how even our poverty level pales in comparison to world poverty. So number three, who are we called to be? Our text says to not invite our friends, but invite the less fortunate to meals. So how is this to play out? I say you can't be helpful to the poor if you don't know them and you don't have access to them. I was just watching the evening news. I think it was Wednesday night. The closing story involved a baseball team for the homeless in Denver. A local entrepreneur was noticing around the city that there were lots of homeless people that spent time around this one particular baseball field that he owns. So he had the idea to invite them all by an invitation on a baseball, he wrote the information on the baseball, to come once a week to play baseball in this field. Once the word got out, it was a big hit. No pun intended. The media interviewed different members of the baseball team. Some felt it was the one thing that picked them up during the week. Batman said that sometimes just a word of encouragement can make all the difference in life. One lady said she just liked feeling that she belonged to something. She often felt she didn't belong when she didn't live in a home. I know the business owner was helping one of the fellows with job leads for employment, but the point is he took the time to get to know them and hear their story and hopefully feed them too. They didn't mention that in the story. Also, as a pilot program in Fairfield County, there is a program called Sharing Hope Bridges Out of Poverty, formatted by Ruby Payne, to be a support system for people in poverty. It's basically structured time every 2 weeks to spend time and talk to people wrestling with getting out of poverty and supporting them through their struggles. There are also programs for those abroad that deserve our attention as well, that I don't know much about. How can we nurture them as a church? I don't know personally, but as a congregation, I think we can conquer that question. Thinking about the needs of others as much as we think about ourselves involves the love that Jesus talks about in the greatest commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself, and involves great humility. I believe God calls us to do this because God knows the great joy that is received by doing this and the great need as well. God often corrals us like the kind grandfather that gently shows us a better way in the kindest way that he can. All Christians need to be corralled into humble work for God because the world is hungry for it and because the world is hungry. But we have to be listening to God to hear that direction. We need to be praying that we are thinking the way God would have us think. Grace UCC is going through a time of great listening to God and deep discernment in both the Art of Neighboring Project and the Pastor Search Committee. The future of this church deserves the deep prayer and discernment from every single person connected. It's time for deep prayer, it's time for deep thinking, deep soul searching, and a time of deep humility. It's a time to continue to pray and look forward to what is best to nurture the congregation's members, a time to pray and look forward to nurturing our neighbors, near and far, and let us not kid ourselves into the importance of that calling. Let us not forget that those who no one in the world can afford to forget, let us know through fervent prayer and treasure time together who we are called to be. Let us embrace the mystery of humility and discernment, and as St. Augustine implied, to embrace humility so greatly that it leads men to act like angels. Amen.